another episode of Redefining the Counterculture right here on Wheaton Radio. Tonight we're joined by a special guest. We're joined by film director Ryan Pilucci. Ryan, how's it going?
It's good. How are you?
Hey, doing well. Thank you so much for joining us on tonight's show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, Ryan, for our listening audience, I was wondering if you could tell us, how did you first become involved with filmmaking, and what was kind of the catalyst that led you into the art form?
Well, I kind of had a, I don't want to say bumpy, but a more circuitous path to this. I actually went to college to play lacrosse. So I didn't know necessarily what I wanted to be when I grew up coming out of high school. In fact, I didn't even know that you could pursue a career in the arts, and that's not just filmmaking, that's anything. I come from a pretty blue-collar background in New York, and you're a cop, a fireman, a lawyer, a doctor, things like that. So the only thing I wanted to do in college was play lacrosse, and I went to school and I played lacrosse, and then I actually went overseas to Cambridge University in England, and it was the first time I was kind of out of this bubble that I was in of, I was headed to law school most likely, and I was there, and I realized, wait a second, I'm going to be 40, and I'm going to hate my life. I think I'm a pretty smart human being if, I'm at Cambridge, which is one of the better schools in the world. What am I doing? Eventually, lacrosse is going to be over, and I need to do something that I love just as much. And I kind of took stock of my life, and I looked around, and everything that I was doing for fun involved filmmaking. And I'm not talking about just watching movies. I was reading books on film lighting. I was reading books on the technical aspects of film just for fun. And I was like, wait a second, maybe this is actually a career in this. And I came back, and much to my parents' dismay, I dropped out of school, transferred to film school eventually. They were not happy. But then I got into USC's producing program, which is the master's producing program at, the best film school in the world. And it wasn't like they were super stoked for me, but they were excited that I had done that. And then that was like the catalyst for the career, sort of, because that's where I met all the people that I work with today. And it helped put me on the map a bit. In terms of, you come out of USC, it's a bit different than when you come out of some other school. It didn't really do much for me other than introduce the classmates and stuff and have to take me more seriously.
Absolutely.
That's kind of how I was, it wasn't the smoothest path. There's a lot in between there that, I played lacrosse for a while after college, and I ruptured a kidney, almost died, and there was a lot that was happening. Kind of short, gave you the short version, but that was how I got into filmmaking, I guess.
Wow. So, I mean, what was it like for you, I guess, like on a personal level, attending USC for film school? Because, like you said, it's a very prestigious program. Do you remember, what your kind of, your initial reaction was when you got accepted into the program?
Yes, I remember the exact moment, actually. So, like I said, I ruptured my kidney. I ruptured my kidney playing lacrosse, and I was in the ICU for a really long time. And during that time, I actually got my letter from USC, and I got waitlisted. And I was like, to be honest, I applied not – it was the only grad school I applied to because I had a finance background, and it's really the only real producing school in the world. UCLA has one, AFI has one, but USC is the cream of the crop. And I was like, yes, I'm not going to go there. I was kind of all or nothing. So I was in the hospital, and I got waitlisted, and I was like, I didn't have time to be sad about it because I was fighting to stay alive. I came out of the hospital, and that was April. I came out of the hospital in July, and I started walking again. And then by August, I was walking to the library, which is about a few miles away. And it was a Thursday, and I was at the library reading, Filmmaker magazine and stuff like that. And I came home, and there was a message on the board from USC to call. and I called, and the guy said, hey, you know, Larry Kerman from USC, to the START program. Class starts Monday. This is the end of August. Class starts Monday. If you can be here by Saturday, you have a spot. I found out they only had 2 people on the wait list, and every year there are, you know, a handful of people that don't go. And I, you know, I literally just started walking again. And I looked at my parents, and I was like, I have 24 hours to get to Los Angeles. And I'd never been to California before, let alone, you know, move my whole life there. And they said, what are you going to do? And I said, let's start packing my car. I took a duffel bag, flew out on Saturday, shipped my car with full life in it, and just kind of was winging it. It was awesome. It was crazy.
Wow. I can only imagine, you know, you're telling me this, and it's like, it's just so vivid. I feel like I'm right there with you, you know, kind of, you know, going through the process. And, you know, it must have been kind of like a scary feeling and an exciting feeling all kind of wrapped in one, I would imagine.
Yeah, totally. It's so vivid, I guess, because I was coming, because I was coming off the wait list, and because it was such a rush thing, and they called me, it was, you know, 3 days before class started, and 4 days, you know, it wasn't just like a normal, hey, you got in, you have 10 months to prepare for this, and which everyone else did. It was crazy.
Man, I bet.
The first semester was just kind of such a whirlwind. I remember it, but it feels like it went by in a day. because I landed and classes started. That Saturday we had like a welcome lunch. You know, there's only 24 students a year in the program, so it's pretty small. And you're just kind of thrown in, and they had all met each other beforehand, and I felt like a real outsider. But you know, that only lasted a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Where would you say, I mean, I know you said, you know, you come from like a very blue-collar background. I've seen the screener for your newest film, Suburban Cowboy, and, you know, like your films are just, I mean, from what I saw on the screener, like I really, really enjoyed your film. And I wanted to just ask you, you know, you mentioned that you come from like a blue collar background. Would you say, like, who would you say are, I guess, like some filmmakers that kind of like truly influenced you and kind of helped you to define your style?
Well, two people that for sure influenced me, not necessarily define my style, just influenced me in giving me the courage to, or just the perspective to say, I can do this, you know, maybe naively. But there's two very specific filmmakers that, while I was at Cambridge, I looked at and said, wait a second, I could potentially do this. One is Ed Burns. You know, he's an Irish Catholic from Long Island. Brothers McMullen was essentially shot in my backyard, you know, metaphorically. You know, we're from the same part of the world. He made a story about the people I know and grew up with. He made it for, you know, I think, was like 26,000 to get in the can, and then kind of blew up off of it, and he was just a normal Long Island kid. So that right there was somebody that I looked at and was like, wow, filmmaking is not done by some magic god in the sky that I can never be. It was the first time I was like, wait a second, it's normal people like me. You know, you see, grow up on movies like Star Wars. I grew up in the 80s, so Star Wars and things like that, where it's, or Spielberg movies, and you know, it's just like these people, you don't realize they grew up in a town just like yours or whatever it is. And then the other filmmaker that I saw that had a really strong impact on me or specific film was Darren Aronofsky's Pi. You know, he's a Brooklyn guy, also a New Yorker, made a movie on reversal stock for, I think it was 60 grand all in, that I saw and was like, wait, this is not flashy, it's not anything crazy, but the movie to this day is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I was just like, not that the movie isn't amazing and that I could do it exactly like that, but I had this thought that was, I could do this. I could be a filmmaker like this. You know, in terms of aspiring to and people that I really look up to, Aronofsky is one of them. You know, I don't love every single movie he's done, but I love him as a filmmaker. And my favorite working filmmaker is probably David Fincher. He's someone that I kind of, like, aspire to. And, you know, my favorite filmmakers, John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick. You know, someone that is probably left off a lot of lists is someone like Danny Boyle. The reason I love Danny Boyle is because every film he does is different, but it's a Danny Boyle movie, if that makes any sense.
And, absolutely.
Like, there's someone like a Paul Greengrass, and he has a very distinct style, the, you know, sort of shaky, cinematic, docu feel. But it's always the same. Whereas Danny Boyle, depending on the story, he'll do something different. The Coen brothers do something like that, too, where you know it's a Coen brother movie, but every single movie is done differently. So, like, Danny Boyle is someone I look up to. Steven Soderbergh, just because he does everything on set. And I think that's kind of where I don't do everything, but I'm of the mindset that you should be able to do everything. For Suburban Cowboy, I did almost everything. Just because it's a necessity when you're operating on the budget that I had. But I'm super excited that you saw it. I didn't know you saw it. That's really great.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was a great movie, and I kind of want to transition to it. I wanted to ask you, what was kind of your what made you or prompted you to do the film? I know that this is something, you know, it's a film that I can tell by the work that you're very passionate about. And it's based on a true story. Tell me a little bit about kind of what the motivating factors were, like, in you know, doing this film.
Well, the biggest factor, can I start at kind of the beginning and get to that? So I have a friend who at the time, you know, was just a normal guy, a friend that you go out with and you grab beers with and you watch football with and everything like that, and he just happened to be one of the biggest weed dealers in New York, in the lower part of New York, Long Island specifically. There's a chance if you were getting weed, and I, you know, to be honest with you, I've actually never smelled pot, which is pretty ironic considering I made a movie about a weed dealer. But if you got pot in the late 90s, early 2000s, there's a chance it came through him or his hands at some point. And he was in jail once, and he wrote essentially his life story down on cocktail napkins and handed it to me when he got out and was like, here, take a look at this. And I was like, come on, man, I can barely read this. So I made him write it out on real paper. And it was very episodic, and it was like, I dated this stripper, and I made this deal, and then I dated this stripper, and then I got robbed, and I dated this stripper, and we did this, I robbed somebody. And I was like, hey, this is all kind of nonsense. Can I take the best parts of this and kind of make it a story that makes sense? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. So we kind of shaped his those stories. So everything in the movie really happened. And then as I was finishing the script, the ending was completely different. And at the time, he got arrested for something else that he wasn't telling anybody he was involved in. So he's actually sitting in federal holding right now and for 2 years so far. So I was like, wait, I'm going to have to go back and change the script to reflect that. And that's the pure MDMA that he was getting from China, and he made a deal for that. He, you know, and I had to kind of work that in there. So for the people that don't know the movie, obviously, this guy is a weed dealer, and he wants to stay a weed dealer, but he gets in over his head, and there's an opportunity for him potentially to get involved in, say, MDMA and make a quicker score. Now, why did I choose this movie over other projects that I'm working on or have scripts for? I love the idea that the guy that lives next door to you, you know, is a criminal. Because I think a lot of times in the media, whether it's film or TV, you see these people that are criminals, and they're so obviously criminals, and they're kind of cartoony in a way. And I don't think it necessarily reflects real life, because obviously this dude is a criminal and he's in jail for it now. And I have other friends that do other things, and they're just really normal people, and they go about life in a really normal way. They just don't punch a clock like we do or other people do. And I don't think that most of the world realizes that. They don't think that the guy next door to them is doing something shady. But they do, and they are, and that fascinated me. And, you know, as I've produced stuff, but I haven't directed a feature, and this is my first feature as a director, and I have a bunch of scripts, and some of them have become graphic novels, and each time I write a script, it's like, hey, I'm going to write a script that's low budget, and it turns out to be, oh, this one's $2 million. All right, this one's $750. This one I can do for $500. Because the market keeps shrinking, you know, as DVDs dry up and theatrical dries up, and it's like you got to keep going smaller to try to get something made. And part of the appeal of this was from the start, before I even put pen to paper, it was, this is going to be really raw. This is going to be really kind of gritty. This is going to be... don't want the camera locked off at all. It's always going to be on the shoulder for the most part. You know, we don't use a tripod, because I think sometimes you do that to because of the budget, and it doesn't always make sense. But I knew that going into the script that that's what it was going to be, and I wrote the script based around locations that I was pretty sure I can get and characters that I knew. It turned out that we didn't shoot it in New York. We actually shot it in Los Angeles for New York, because my partner was like, has a baby. My partner on the film and the investor on the movie has a baby, and he was like, I can't go to New York, so let's just shoot it around this. So it worked out in the end, but that was kind of like why this project at this time in my life. You know, you don't get so many chances to direct a movie, and when they come up, you know, you can jump at them.
Absolutely. You know,
did I answer your question? I know I just went off on a tangent.
No. You did. I mean, you answered perfectly. I mean, it gave me some real insight. And I kind of wanted to kind of get more into it. But I know you said, you know, like, this is the first feature that you've directed. So, and I know that you're extremely proud of it. The work that you've done is amazing. How do you feel about it personally, with this being your first feature? Do you feel like you accomplished everything that you set out for?
Yes. I knew going in that we wouldn't be casting names, so to speak. And it would be no names, and partly because, you know, we could have went and got, you know, the kid from Teen Wolf or something ridiculous like that. And I think, you know, maybe it makes people in the industry feel better. I don't think general moviegoers are necessarily tuning in for some low-level, you know, I don't want to rag on anybody, but some low-level, like, CW star or something like that. Theatrically, at least, or anything like that. And I wanted it also to feel authentic and not cast some, you know, ex-model as the lead who's supposed to be a drug dealer, which I think happens a lot. And you watch a movie and you just roll your eyes when someone's trying to be tough. So I say this because the way it looks, I think, is awesome. I'm extremely proud of what we were able to accomplish visually and on the production value side. In fact, most of the distributors are coming back saying that they love it. They think the performances are awesome. They just can't put it out theatrically because there's no names. And I was like, it was never supposed to be named, and I didn't necessarily make – we made it at a budget where it was – I knew I didn't need to sell it for a lot and go theatrically or anything like that to make the money back or profit. So to hear, hey, we love it, but there's no names in it, so we can't put it out, is like – it's kind of fine. It is what it is, and I'm not going to complain about that because I knew going in that would be the case. That would be the only thing that I kind of am like, well, if I had more money, that's what I would spend it on. But then it's a different movie, and it's not kind of as raw as this one is, and there's something to be said about your first film being really raw, like a Pie, like a Brothers McMullen, like a you know, Do the Right Thing. None of those guys were known at the time. But, you know, musically, you know, for the sound, we don't have a single line of ADR. And it's not everything sounds clear, at least as far as I know. There's not a single visual effect in the movie. There's animated, hand-drawn animated titles at the beginning and the end. And there's a animated... You'll know this because you saw it. But there's an animated thing in the middle, an animated shadow. It's not a visual effect shot. It's actually hand-drawn animation. There's not a single visual effect shot in the film, and that's something I'm extremely proud of, especially on a movie like this where sometimes you cover things up and you say, oh, you need visual effects to solve something or a problem. The fact that we don't have any, I think, speaks volumes about the crew that I was working with and what we were able to do. You know, we had a 17-day shooting schedule. We were so efficient that we cut it down to 16 days. You know, our sound guy was so good that we didn't have to bring in anybody on ADR. And that's kind of what I'm proud of more than anything, is that I was able to crew up with the right people. And you know, even down to the PAs, I interviewed everybody face-to-face. I didn't just take people's word for it when they said, I know somebody or I know this. And there were no bad apples on the crew, and it was actually the best set I've ever been on, you know, from top to bottom. And the whole experience was really great. Now, I'm coming off of a movie that's in post where I was a writer and producer on, lead producer. It's, the whole thing is visual effects. Two-thirds of the movie is set in space, and there's... 1,100 visual effect shots, and it's a completely different type of movie. But that set was a mess. Everyone hated each other and everything, but I was kind of bracing myself for that. And it wasn't. It was pretty awesome. I feel like I'm spoiled now because I'm always going to be expecting that. And
absolutely.
And especially the actors, we're all grateful to be there, and you don't necessarily get that when you start paying people more because, you know, you hear about these nightmare actors and actresses that you hope you don't get stuck with, because people can say a lot of things right up until the cameras roll or they sign their contract and they become somebody different.
Absolutely, yeah. There's countless stories like that where, you know, people – flip the script, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I dealt with a similar situation on the animated. Right out of grad school, I started a company with a classmate, and the first thing we did was an animated film. And we built a CG studio from scratch in L.A. That's something I was really proud of, more proud of that than the movie itself. And the director, super humble, my dream is to make a movie. As soon as we signed the agreement, it was... like he thought he was Steven Spielberg. The guy completely went off the rails. It was really insane. And I think he paid the price for it in the end.
Absolutely.
So absolutely. Anyone listening, if they're in the arts, like, continue, if you're humble, don't let it be an act. Continue to be humble. I've been humbled a lot, you know, coming out of grad school. You know, I thought I was hot shit when I graduated, and I'm actually glad to some degree that I didn't have the immediate success that I think some other people have, because I just think I could have been a real asshole. But I had a lot of projects fall apart at the last second. A lot of times money is promised and it's not delivered, and it's a kind of a bumpy path. And I went the independent path, which is much harder.
Absolutely. What would you say is, you know, the biggest misconception about filmmaking and kind of the world of filmmaking? I mean, obviously it's, you know, it's an art form that, you know, a lot of people, you know, love and enjoy, but not a lot of people have kind of the insight, you know, into, you know, what it takes to create a film or to act in a film or so on and so forth. But you as a, you know.
I'm sorry, go on.
Go right ahead. I was going to ask, you as a, you know, as a producer and a film director yourself, what would you say is the biggest misconception?
I think the biggest misconception is, I would say there's two of them. Going into it, choosing a career like this, is the misconception that success happens quickly. You need to be willing to sacrifice everything. You know, I've gone through periods where I've had $200 in my bank and everyone is saying, you're a really smart guy. You need a plan B. This isn't working out. And if you do not love film or whatever art you're choosing, if you're doing it to get girls or if you're doing it as a girl to get guys or whatever it is to have a good time, you're in the wrong path. You need to be willing to sacrifice everything. And if you have a plan B, you've already failed. That's my opinion. Obviously, people don't share that opinion and they have to see a lot of success. That's what I'd say the biggest misconception is going in, that I'm going to do this one thing and see it and then become the next big shot of whatever field you're in. And it doesn't necessarily work like that. You need to be willing to claw your way up, work hard. You know, as a director, you need to direct. You know, these people that move out to LA and say, I want to be a director, and they start working as grips and gaffers and stuff. And from a young age, I was looking at the credits, and you never see the first AD become a director. You never see the gaffer become a director. Look at all the films that you love. Those people stay gaffers. Those people stay grips. And there's nothing wrong with that, but if you want to be a director, you need to direct. So roll up your sleeves and direct. Do something for no money, and then do something for a little money, and then do something for more money. And then once you're in the industry, when you're actually making something, I think the biggest misconception is that, and I'll just give it from a director's point of view, is I'm just a director. I need to deal with camera and actors and things like that. The producer will handle it. And the market has completely changed. You know, you're not in the same world you were in even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. You know, money is hard to come by, and when you do have it, it doesn't go as far as it used to. So if you're a director and you don't know what things cost, you don't know what the people on your crew do, you don't know the post-production process, you don't know the pre-production process, you don't know those things, like, you are setting yourself up for failure. It's not that hard to learn these things, and I think the biggest misconception is that someone else will take care of it, because someone else will not take care of it. No one loves your movie as much as you do.
Absolutely.
Dealing with it for a year, you know, I cut it. I'm handling all the sales. I'm dealing with the sales agents. I'm Like, no one else is doing that for me. I have a partner on the movie. I'm the one doing it. Because they don't, they're just not as emotionally invested as I am, and no one will be, especially when it's something you wrote, directed, all those things, which I would think a lot of first-time filmmakers are. They're directing things that maybe they wrote. Your producer does not care about it as much as you do. As much as you want them to, they don't care as much. Your sales agents don't care as much as you do. So, you know, put it like, you just need to be well-versed in everything, and if you're not, make yourself. So easy. Just Google it.
Absolutely.
You know, sounds ridiculous, but it's true. You know, like, I can give you a pretty specific example. Like, right now, my agency that's selling domestic rights, you know, we made a list, and they made a list, and I added to it. And as it's going on, I could have just sat back and said, oh, they'll sell my movie for me. But I kept doing research on companies that maybe were, you know, smaller and that stuff. And the person that's interested is the person that I presented to them, a domestic distributor that I presented to them later in the game, that would have never even come across their desk because they're a big agency and they don't deal with the smaller ones, and this is probably the best home for our movie. You need to be working for yourself at all times, and you can't do that if you don't know what you're doing. So directing isn't always just about the creative side of things. Not anymore. And, you know, maybe if you're on a studio movie.
Absolutely.
I give you two answers to that one. Two for the price of one.
Which is really good. Which is really good. I wanted to talk to you now. Your newest film, Suburban Cowboy. What do you have in the works in terms of upcoming things? I know. I think it premiered at the Austin Film Festival.
It's actually this Saturday. This coming Saturday.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go to the fest. It premieres on Saturday, and then we have a follow-up screening on Monday night. Pretty excited. I don't know what to expect, to be honest with you. It's a pretty dark, gritty, raw movie. I hope people love it, but you just never know. You know, all you can do is kind of, you put it out there in the world, and you can't be upset if people reject it, because not everyone's going to love it. I've kind of come to terms with that. I put out two graphic novels already besides the movies I've done, and those are really personal because they're books, you know, and it's such a smaller audience, and they're, it's hard, but you didn't spend all this time and effort doing something to not share it with the world. And if people don't like it, you can't argue with them. You know, it's really embarrassing sometimes when you see creators of any kind, in any medium, put something out there and people criticize it, and then they come firing back at them. It's really embarrassing. You know, why did you put it out there? You can't expect everyone to love it.
Absolutely.
But you were asking, are you going to ask what else am I working on?
Yes, because I know you have the premiere this week, and I apologize. I thought it had already passed, but do you plan to debut the film at any more film festivals?
Well, this right now is the main one that's going to kind of – we start AFM, which is the American Film Market, is the first week of November, and our foreign sales start then. Like, I don't want to jinx it, but I'm inching really close to locking up this domestic distribution deal, and if that's the case, then I don't necessarily need to be at any festivals besides Austin, and this has been in the works for a few weeks, if not months. So I've kind of put my focus on that rather than the festival route because Austin is happening. And it's not that I wasn't, you know, like, hey, this festival would be great, but kind of between often and the end of the year, there's really no major festivals. The next big one would be Sundance. And by then, hopefully, we have distribution sewn up. So I don't necessarily see the point of it. Or at least I don't have that planned yet. You know, ideally we get distribution and it comes out before then or right around then.
Okay. All right. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your graphic novels. I know you said you have some graphic novels that are out. Obviously, you know, with comic books and graphic novels, those are almost kind of like an extension of filmmaking because, you know, a lot of times, like you have the panel by panel, you know, approach to storytelling. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your graphic novels that are out there and where we can purchase them.
Well, the first one is called Harbor Moon. It was actually written to be kind of a spaghetti western mystery, and it just so happens to have werewolves. So when the book came out, everyone labeled it a horror comic, and I wrote it with a partner that I work with from USC, and we were like, oh, it's a horror book. And not like I didn't think that was cool. I didn't even think about it because in our heads we wrote this mystery that just happened to be set in this kind of modern-day spaghetti western, and it just so happened to involve werewolves. That's Harbor Moon. It's pretty much everywhere. We've won a bunch of, like, independent awards for it, especially for the coloring. It's all hand-painted. That was a kick in the ass, that book. It was, you know, I just produced the animated film, and I was like, I just produced this animated movie. Of course I can put together a graphic novel. But they're two totally separate things, and the graphic novel presented a lot of challenges that I had to work through and figure out and made me better for the second one. But that's pretty much everywhere. Definitely through, if you get it through spokelane.com, I'll actually sign them, and I'll be the one sending it to you.
Okay.
And then the other book is REM, R-E-M. It's about, and that's a black and white book, but it's like really what I think is high end in terms of the printing and stuff. We didn't spare any expense. It's on silk paper, and the blacks are super deep black. And it's black and white because just felt like the story deserved to be black and white, not color. The best way to describe that is like it's my version of Pi, the Aronofsky film, which had a big influence on me. It's about a scientist that's trying to beat sleep. So he is looking to create essentially a sleep chair that tricks your brain into the cycles of REM, and you get a full night's sleep in a half hour. And he kind of comes apart at the seams because of it and after it. It's actually based on, I'm simplifying the kind of technical part of it. It's based on real research I was doing because I don't like sleeping. And I don't like being tired either. So if you were to get a full night's sleep with no issues, then you would never be tired and your time would be more productive and everything. So he's trying to do this, and it's a really personal story as well, and it's a smaller story, more character-driven. I'm loathe to say highbrow because they're going to sound really pretentious, but I don't think you see a lot of graphic novels about scientists trying to beat sleep. There's no case or anything like that, and there's no big crime subplot. Just a guy that goes a little crazy, and there's people after it that are potentially use it for their own purposes. Like the Naval has a division. The Navy has a division that's based on science, and they're after it and things like that. So that you can get right through my website, and I would sign them. It's on Amazon, and those go right through me as well.
Very nice.
I have three books in production right now as well. And my partner from REM, actually. His name is John Bohuska. It was the first thing we ever worked on together. And he's somebody I'll never do anything without at this point. Everything I've done since then, he's been involved with. He did the hand-drawn animated title sequence for Suburban Cowboy, which was nominated for Excellence in Title Design at South by Southwest this last year. And I thought it was kind of like a throwaway thing. I was looking for title design competitions because we weren't ready for anything but the titles, and everyone's like, these titles are awesome. So I found this one title design competition at South by Southwest, and I entered, and we got in. And then I realized the titles that we were up against were Avengers, Age of Ultron, Spectre, the Daredevil title sequence. It was crazy. I was like, what? Enough? That's really cool.
Yeah, that's it.
And then he was doing, we were in various stages on the other two books that he's working on with me. And we were also working on an animated, hand-drawn animated feature idea. And we just said, screw it. And we took out a Kickstarter to raise money for a short based on it. And that kind of took off. And we are, right now I'm directing that, a hand-drawn animated short, 16-minute thing called Orient City, which is world that we created that is a mix of like the Old West and samurais. And the Kickstarter brought forth a lot of attention, especially there was an investor that stepped up, and he's financing now the pre-production of the feature all the way through the animatic. So by June 1st of next year, you'll be able to sit down and watch at least a full animatic of the movie. And by December of this year, so in a month and a half, 2 months or so, the short will be finished.
Very nice, very nice. Okay. And Brian...
Yeah, that's been kicking my butt. That and trying to get, also being the person that's primarily responsible for all the Suburban Cowboy things, like dealing with tales and everything. I keep jumping over you.
No, it's totally fine. That's okay. I wanted to ask, where can our listening audience find out more about you and keep abreast of the many projects that you're working on?
The one social media place where I'm the most active is Instagram. And my handle is SpokeLane, SpokeLane. That's the name of my company, but, I mean, company is stretching it. Company is me. So I post a lot of stuff there. I'm also on Twitter under SpokeLane. The Facebook page is Facebook.com/SpokeLane. And then SpokeLane.com has all that stuff and trailers and artwork, and that's probably the best place if you want to get an overview. But to stay current, it's probably Instagram. I haven't gotten into Snapchat. Maybe I'm too old. But even the Instagram stories part, which is, I guess, their version of Snapchat, kind of doesn't do anything for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was playing on it the other day, and I was like, yeah, this is totally like a ripoff of Snapchat, but I still can't seem to get it.
I was like, if this is Snapchat, why are people on Snapchat?
Right.
Instagram just seems easy. It's like I got to put up a picture and you scroll through them. It's like Facebook, but better.
Absolutely.
It's not all politics right now. It's just pictures of people's kids. And I post a lot of like stills from stuff we're working on, or character design stuff from Orient City, or panels from the comics and things like that.
Very cool. Okay. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this interview with me. And I'm all out of questions, but I wanted to open the floor to you if there's anything you'd like to say to our listening audience.
No, I feel like I talked a lot. The only thing I'd say is I know most of your audience is in the arts, right? Just don't give up. So, you know, I'm here getting interviewed, but it's not like I'm more of a success than you out there listening. It's just a matter of working harder and persevering, because you need to sacrifice to get to where you want to go, and it's not going to happen right away, and you're going to fail. I fail every day. There's not a single day that goes by I don't fail at something, but I keep going, and that's the only way that I've gotten to where I am. You know, I've outlasted people.
And there's something to be said about perseverance, you know. Perseverance is huge.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. And, you know, I think if you're listening to this, probably weren't either. And you just got to keep going. Don't give up. Don't give up your dreams. Ever. Don't let someone tell you to get a plan B.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Ryan, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was great talking to you.
Likewise. Guys,
I'm glad you liked the movie.
Yes, it was very, very good. Very good. And in fact, I was going to say, guys, if you're listening, well, actually, I should probably ask you this for the listeners, but where can our listeners see the film? I know that it's probably only going to be available in select cities, but will it be available on video on demand?
Yeah, as soon as we wrap up the details of the distribution agreement, it'll be everywhere. You're not going to find it in your local theater. It'll be all over VOD. Eventually, you know, you get the VOD window, and then you get the Netflix, Amazon window. So once that happens, this company is great at that, at the VOD market and making sure it's everywhere. Potentially Redbox, which is pretty hard to get. So as soon as it's out, it'll be everywhere that people can see it, just not theatrically. And I think that's also sometimes what filmmakers are so obsessed with, is getting their movie in theaters. And the reality is that it's really hard, and it's not necessarily financially feasible, you know, if you want to make money. To run a theatrical film, you need to spend money to market it, and that money is better spent marketing a VOD title. But to answer your question, it's going to be on VOD, it's going to be on Netflix, it's going to be on Amazon. It's just a matter of when. Don't know exactly yet. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes, because we got to – I mean, the world needs to see this film. It's really good film. No.
I don't know about that. I mean, I hope they do, but it's not changing the world. It's a fun movie, though, I think.
Yeah, it is. I would definitely say it's a fun movie. I mean, considering, you know, it's a dark tale, it's a dark story, you know, it still ends up being a fun movie. So.
Yeah. You know, once you get that phone call at the end of the first act, it doesn't really let you up for air. That was our goal. So it's kind of a speeding train until the end.
Absolutely. Well, Ryan, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Have a good night.
Oh, you as well. Guys, that was film director Ryan Colucci. If you're listening to this on SoundCloud, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. We're also on your mobile phone, your mobile device. You can download the Stitcher Smart Radio app. It's available for free in the Google Play as well as the iTunes Store. Download the app, search for our name, Redefining the Counterculture. Also, if you're an Android user, have no fear. We're also available in the Google Play Music Store. Just go to the Google Play Music Store, search for our show name, Redefining the Counterculture. You can stream this interview, download it, rate us, share it with friends, leave a comment, all free of charge.